Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Ann Ball, Pete Musto, Brian Lin, Mario Ritter, Dan Friedel, and Anna Mateo. First, Ann Ball and Pete Musto bring us the first in a two-part series on Muslim American voters who are increasingly voting for Democratic Party candidates.
Muslim voters in the United States are increasingly moving toward the Democratic Party. They are expected to vote in record numbers for Democrat Hillary Clinton in the U.S. presidential election in November. Muslim Americans were once seen as supporters of the Republican Party. In fact, a large majority of them voted for Republican George W. Bush in the 2000 presidential election. But opinion surveys show they are more likely to support Clinton than Donald Trump, the Republican candidate, in the November vote. And some critics say the Republican Party has lost a chance to keep an increasingly influential group of voters.
Public opinion surveys completed after the 2000 election found that more than 70% of Muslim American voters supported George W. Bush. Most of the 50,000 Muslim voters in the state of Florida marked their ballots for the then Texas governor. Experts note that Bush won the presidency only because he won in Florida. He captured the state after receiving 537 more votes than his leading opponent, Al Gore. Muslim Americans and many conservatives believed that Bush's victory in Florida showed the growing influence of Muslim voters. And they said it showed that Republicans and Muslims shared many of the same values and beliefs.
Suhail Khan is a well-known Muslim American and a Republican. He once served as a board member of the American Conservative Union. In the magazine Foreign Policy, he noted that most Muslim Americans are both socially and economically conservative, like many Republicans. Many Muslim Americans and Republicans do share conservative values, like supporting strong families and traditional marriage. They also oppose legalization of operations for ending pregnancies. Khan noted that about one-fourth of Muslim Americans own small businesses. He said they support Republican efforts to lower taxes.
But some observers believe there is another reason so many Muslim Americans voted for George W. Bush in 2000. John Esposito is a professor at Georgetown University and wrote a book called The Future of Islam. He says Muslim Americans may have thought that Bush would have ideas similar to those of his father, former President George H.W. Bush. They liked the former president's way of dealing with the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. But Muslim Americans soon had different ideas about George W. Bush. In the 2004 election, more than 90% of them supported his opponent, Senator John Kerry. 4 years later, 89% of Muslim Americans voted for Democrat Barack Obama. In 2012, he won 85% of the Muslim American vote, according to several estimates.
So, why did so many Muslims stop voting for Republican candidates after the 2000 election? The most common answer given by Muslim activists is that there was a rise in Islamophobia, a fear or distrust of Muslims. Many Muslim Americans also came to believe that U.S. foreign policy harmed Muslims around the world. After the attacks of September 11, 2001, President Bush stated that the United States was not at war with Islam. But since then, Republican policies and comments have persuaded many Muslims that the party is home to many Americans who do not like them. Robert McCaw is with the Council on American-Islamic Relations. He says, sadly, the Republican Party over the past 15 years has become the political epicenter of Islamophobia, introducing anti-Muslim policy proposals or anti-foreigner laws in at least 10 state legislatures. This has really driven the Muslim vote out of the Republican Party.
But Islamophobia and foreign policy alone do not explain why Muslim Americans have turned toward the Democratic Party. Georgetown's John Esposito says another reason might be the Republican position on immigration. He notes that most Muslim Americans are immigrants. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Ann Ball.
We will have part two of this story on tomorrow's program. You are listening to VOA Learning English.
Businessman Jeff Bezos has announced two new rocket designs to launch satellites and people into space. Most people know Bezos as the founder and chief executive officer of online seller Amazon. However, the rocket designs come from his private space company, Blue Origin. The two reusable rockets are called New Glenn. The name refers to astronaut John Glenn, the first American to orbit Earth in 1962. The New Glenn two-stage rocket stands 82 meters high and is designed to reach low Earth orbit. A three-stage version, measuring 95 meters, is meant to travel beyond Earth's orbit. The first stage of both rockets will be powered by seven engines using liquid natural gas and liquid oxygen as fuel. The new designs are based on Blue Origin's smaller New Shepard rocket, which has successfully launched four times. Bezos said the new rockets should be ready for flight before the end of this decade. They will take off from the historic Launch Complex 36 in Cape Canaveral, Florida. Our vision is millions of people living and working in space, and New Glenn is a very important step, Bezos said in an email announcing his plans. Bezos has said Blue Origin plans to launch satellites into orbit for companies at a lower cost. It also plans to transport tourists into space. The company's business model depends on the ability to reuse parts of the rockets over and over again. Other private space companies are based on the same model. One of Blue Origin's main competitors is SpaceX. Owned by businessman and investor Elon Musk. Musk also operates electric car company Tesla Motors. So far, SpaceX has successfully launched and landed rockets 6 times. 2 of the rockets landed on the ground, and 4 touched down on a platform floating in the sea. SpaceX recently planned another launch, but its Falcon 9 rocket exploded during a pre-launch test 2 days before liftoff on September 1st. The cause of the explosion is being investigated. The accident at Cape Canaveral destroyed the rocket and a communications satellite that was built for Facebook. The social media network planned to use the satellite to provide high-speed internet service to parts of Africa. Bezos noted that Blue Origin places high importance on not moving too quickly with development. "We believe slow is smooth and smooth is fast," he said. "In the long run, deliberate and methodical wins the day, and you do things quickest by never skipping steps." Bezos said the company would not stop at New Glenn and hinted at plans for an even bigger rocket. "Up next on our drawing board, New Armstrong," he said. But that's a story for the future. That rocket would be named after astronaut Neil Armstrong, the first human to walk on the moon in 1969. I'm Mario Ritter.
What happens to our images on social media or the internet after we die? Evan Carroll is someone who thinks a lot about this question. Carroll co-wrote a book called Your Digital Afterlife. He says there are companies that will collect your passwords and online information. These businesses then provide all the important details to your family so they can make sure your accounts are settled after you die. Carroll said some online businesses will put together the digital story of your life to keep your memory alive long after you die. Some companies will even send out messages for you to your friends and family members after your death. There are some concerns, however. Carroll said one problem is that it is normal to put off dealing with death. Many people hope and believe death is far off into the future. Another problem is that companies sometimes go out of business. In other words, they might not be around when you die to send along your messages and passwords. Facebook says it has 1.71 billion monthly users worldwide, making it the largest social media website. Carroll said people are not happy to get messages on their Facebook page about birthdays for friends who have died.
Now, Facebook will let a relative or friend memorialize a Facebook friend's page, as long as they can provide proof of death. That could be a copy of a death notice. In 2015, Facebook set up another program. It lets a person choose a family member or friend who can supervise the individual's Facebook account after they die. That person can write information about a memorial service or share a special message or memory, Facebook said. One group working to create digital memories is the Hereafter Institute at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art in California. Started a year ago, the Institute offers people the chance to learn how they can plan their digital afterlife. People who visit Hereafter learn how personal information and video images can be placed into a piece of jewelry as a future memorial. The founder of the Institute is Gabriel Barcia Colombo. He used old audio, pictures, and videos to create a lasting video about his grandfather. Video lets people think about how friends and family members moved or reacted to jokes or how they laughed, he said. Watching the images of his grandfather was important to him, Barcia Colombo said. To be able to see him walking again was very moving to me. People who visit the Institute get a body scan. They can then watch as an image of that body scan walks into the distance. Carolina Miranda is a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times newspaper. She recently spent time at the Institute. She said the image works as a memorial, although it is not exactly a perfect copy. I don't think it would ever be in danger of becoming something that you could almost grow attached to because it's a replacement of that person, Miranda said. Barcia Colombo said the goal of his institute is to make people think about what is possible and what they might want to do with their online memories after they die.
Students in the American state of Virginia will soon be able to order burritos carried by unmanned aircraft. The food delivery service is starting at the Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University in Blacksburg, Virginia. This will be one of the first tests of a commercial drone delivery service in the United States. Virginia Tech's Project Wing is partnering with the restaurant company Chipotle Mexican Grill on the experiment. Project Wing is part of X, a laboratory once known as Google X. It researches and tests unmanned aerial vehicles, also known as drones. The lab studies the use of drones to transport food, medicine, and other goods. After the students place their order, the burritos will be made at a food truck and loaded onto a drone. The aircraft will fly the burritos to a pickup area, then lower them to the ground. The drones are able to fly like a plane or hover in the air like a helicopter. The flights will be limited to an area on Virginia Tech property away from the main campus grounds, according to the university's Mid-Atlantic Aviation Partnership. The partnership is one of six groups approved by the Federal Aviation Administration to carry out unmanned drone tests. Only a small group of people at Virginia Tech will be able to use the service at first, according to the director of the partnership, Mark Blanks. Mark Warner of Virginia serves in the U.S. Senate. He said the research will help improve the development of unmanned aircraft technology. The commercial use of drones for package and food delivery in U.S. airspace is rapidly becoming a reality, he said. In addition to Google's parent Alphabet, other companies are testing drones as a way to make deliveries faster and more efficient. These include Amazon, UPS, FedEx, and Domino's Pizza. The FAA recently estimated there will be about 600,000 commercial drones operating in the United States within 1 year. The agency made the estimate while announcing new rules for commercial drone operators. The tests are seen as important because they can demonstrate the ability to deliver fresh, hot food without involving humans. Virginia Tech said the Burrito Project will explore food delivery with limitations such as time, amount, temperature, frequency, and packaging. This is the most complex delivery flight operation that I am aware of that's occurred on U.S. soil, Blanks told Bloomberg. I'm Brian Lynn.
This is What's Trending Today. Roald Dahl is a beloved British writer. He is the author of some of the world's best-known children's novels, including James and the Giant Peach, Matilda, and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. More than 250 million copies of his books have been sold worldwide. His works have been translated into 58 languages. Tuesday was Roald Dahl Day. People around the world celebrated what would have been Dahl's 100th birthday. He was born on September 13, 1916, in Wales to Norwegian parents. He died in 1990. Hashtag Roald Dahl Day trended worldwide on social media. Many people thanked Dahl for making them truly enjoy reading. Special events and celebrations were held in Britain and other countries in honor of Dahl. The Oxford English Dictionary marked Dahl's 100th birthday by officially adding six Dahl-created words to its latest edition. They included words such as Oompa Loompa and Scrum Diddly Umptious. Oompa Loompas are the factory workers in the book Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. They had orange skin and green hair. They danced and played music. Oompa Loompas became more famous after the 1971 film version of the book, which starred Gene Wilder as candy maker Willy Wonka. Scrum Diddly Umptious is a word that appeared in Dahl's book, The BFG, short for the Big Friendly Giant. It generally means delicious. A film version of The BFG, directed by Steven Spielberg, was released this year. Earlier this year, Oxford released an entire Roald Dahl dictionary. It included more than 8,000 real and invented words used by the master storyteller. And that's what's trending today. I'm Anna Mateo.
It may seem like a nightmare for some people, but for others, it sounds like a fun game. Escape rooms are becoming a popular form of group entertainment in the United States. A story by the business website MarketWatch explains that escape room games began in Asia about 10 years ago. In 2012, they started opening in the U.S. Now, according to the website Escape Room Directory, you can go to an escape room location in nearly every U.S. state, not to mention Australia, Asia, the Middle East, and most of Europe. The idea is simple. Players enter a room with a theme. It could be a Sherlock Holmes mystery, or something like the movie series Mission Impossible. The door locks behind them. The players then have 60 minutes to solve a series of puzzles that will help them find a key that unlocks the door. VOA visited an escape room lounge in Washington, D.C. One of the rooms is in the theme of the Oval Office at the White House. That is the well-known room where the president works and holds meetings. The space is decorated to look like the real Oval Office. It even has the presidential seal woven into the rug. When the clock starts and the door locks, anything inside the room can be a clue. Players look through the desk, look at the paintings on the wall, even see if an old-fashioned typewriter might help. The goal is to make it out of the room before time runs out. There are hidden messages that can only be seen under a special light. By one estimate, there are about 600 escape rooms in the U.S. Timothy Smith runs the Escape Lounge in Washington. When he opened his business, there were two others in the area. Now there are at least 12. The escape room games cost about $15 per player. Most of the time, players come in groups, but sometimes strangers work together. In this case, 8 players cooperated to find the key. If a team is having trouble or getting off track, the game master, who is watching on a video screen, can call in to offer some advice or a clue. The phone on the Oval Office desk rings, and the game master asks, "Would you guys like a clue?" The tip seems to help, and the group is able to solve the puzzle, find the key, and leave the room with 7 minutes to spare. It turns out they did well. Smith said fewer than 50% of the players escape the room. One of the players was Dimitrios Sihopaidas. He said the game was stressful and the clues were hard to figure out. "I was a little worried that we were not going to find all the clues and we weren't going to get out in time," he said. Smith said the games are fun because they are challenging. Escape the Oval Office is not an easy game. "I think this game is popular because it gives an individual a chance to be a detective or to be a James Bond." I'm Dan Friedel.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.